एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। वी मीट सम ऑफ द मोस्ट सेलिब्रेटेड स्टार्टअप फाउंडर्स इन द कंट्री
एंड वी वांट टू लर्न हाउ टू बिल्ड अ यूनिकॉर्न।
There are many IITians who have gone to Silicon Valley and built successful startups. There are a few of them who have also sold their businesses for millions of dollars. There are maybe a handful of them who have come back to India after such a successful run in the valley to build startups that solve problems in India. And our guest today is one of those extremely rare entrepreneurs who built and exited a startup in the Silicon Valley, came back to India and became an integral part of the Aadhaar Card launch initiative, then became a VC before taking another plunge into entrepreneurship with his fintech startup MoneyTap, which is among the leading B2C lending fintech platforms in the country. Listen to him narrate his amazing journey to Akshay Tat in this episode of the Founder Thesis podcast.
Chennai. So I grew up and did my college in the 1980s, 84 to 88, at IIT Madras. So I was born and brought up in Chennai and Madras in those times, and studied in IIT Madras as well. Dad was a government servant, so he was in the Central Excise, and so he was at a mid-level position, and mom was a housewife.
Were you a risk taker as a kid? Like, you know, did that risk taking thing get started as a child, or like how did that come about, that you know that entrepreneurial bug?
It's a great question, and I've been sort of wondering about that over time. As a child, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s in in South India, in a sort of a Tambram kind of a family which I was a part of, definitely risk taking was not in my blood, and nobody I knew other than one uncle of mine who went around to start a business had ever taken any risk, right? So the mantra in those days was, and given the economy which India was at that time, was not exactly to start a business, right? So businessmen were like sort of this evil industrialists.
Hollywood villains.
Correct. So that's the movies you watch are all like, you know, Amitabh Bachchan revolting, against sort of the rich class, right? It was a very socialist, that was what the stories we were told are. Hmm. So starting a business was A, not possible, and B, was evil. So that was not even in my horizon. So I would say the one interesting thread which might have started this, which has been throughout with me from throughout my life, was that I definitely had an interest in travel.
Okay.
So when I was a child, you know, we pretty much grew up in South India, Chennai, never knew like life outside Tamil Nadu pretty much. But Dad used to have this, what they call LTC, I think it's still there if you're a government officer.
Yes, right.
You're allowed like one trip out. So those days it was really unusual to, people usually use it for pilgrimage, to go to some temple town or something. But Dad took us to Kashmir. And this is like, way before the whole insurrection started. Kashmir was beautiful, but some of that, I think, was a spark in terms of saying, hey, the first time you go to, Delhi and, go to Kashmir, people speaking different language, wearing different clothes. It was really going to a different country, honestly. A language which I did not understand a word of. So that was a very eye-opening kind of a event, and that sort of triggered an interest in travel. So later on, when I got into IIT, I still was not thinking entrepreneurship or anything, but I was definitely very interested in sort of travel. Okay. And one thing that also happened in IIT was that somewhat accidentally, I got into a summer job. And it was not done. Summer jobs were not done at that time. Right. Side jobs never done. But almost all through IIT, I had a side job and a summer job.
Okay.
And the job was nothing to do with what I studied, but the job was for doing market research. Somehow I accidentally got into this, where you
was could, it to earn pocket money?
It was basically only pocket money.
Yeah. Okay.
So I mean, college education was in IIT was somewhat subsidized, right? You know, the fees were like 200 rupees a year. But that definitely did not have any money for anything other than sort of basic hostel and college fees, which was the case with almost all my friends as well. But the side job in market research, which was very new at the time, where you could go to, you know, tea shops and restaurants and ask them which, you know, brand of tea they used, or, you know,
FMCG market research.
Houses, right? Door to door, seeing what soaps you use, you know, stuff like that, which very consumer market research. Somehow I got into this and I kind of liked the money-making aspect of it, right? So I got the taste of what is it to sort of make your own, make some money on the side. As a college student, you know, you could always use for, use some extra cash.
Right.
So actually what happened with that is that it sort of started taking me places. So from sort of door to door, shop to shop, it was very brutal. You know, imagine going to a tea shop and standing and asking that guy how many teas he sells, right? That is the kind of thing I used to do as an IIT student, which was not exactly, you know, done. But then I kind of graduated from there to do industrial surveys, right? Where you would go to factories and ask how many bags of cement they produced, or, you know, strange places. So that kind of got me into travel, and I would travel, you know, across South India, all over the place. I didn't know, right? And try, you know, this is sort of pre-internet, pre-telephone days, right? So you basically just go up. And of course, you know, having the IIT brand helps. I would just say I'm an IIT student, and I would basically go straight talk to the MD of the factory.
Wow, okay.
But so that obviously I used whatever I could. But what it did do was, A, not only I made a lot more money, but also got to travel to places which I would not normally go to, which, you know, was very unusual, right? Because nobody knew where I was. My parents didn't know where I was. I would just take a suitcase and go to, you know, Shimoga or some random places which...
Yeah, no Google Maps, no phone.
No Google Maps, no idea. Just ask people, and I didn't speak the language, whatever. Just sort of figure it out, right?
Yeah.
So no advanced booking, no Google Maps, right? No train booking, right? There was no online booking. You just show up at the railway station and take an unreserved train and go. Right? I did a lot of that almost every summer.
Okay.
So that was kind of one interesting phase, one thread. And later on, you know, that kind of went, and even now it continues, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But a sense of sort of adventure and a sense of sort of curiosity and exploration, coupled with also a thread of actually making money, you know, interest in, you know, working and making some money was kind of exciting thing to do on the side. The other thread
not was, affect your grades and all, like,
yeah, I totally did. So I was not a good student particularly, and partly also because I studied chemical engineering, which was what I got into IIT for, and I sucked at it. So So I hated it. First of all, I didn't like it. And then I was also not good at it.
Why did you pick it up? Because it was like the thing to do.
In those days, IIT, you had no choice.
Okay.
Right? So pretty much whatever your rank, JE rank was, you got, like, you know, there's like a picking order.
Okay.
Right? The top 100 people got into computer science. And, you know, if your rank was 750 something, my rank
would. Did computer science exist as a field in 80s?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So computer science existed. It was just nascent. It was just coming up. So remember, I'm totally dating myself. So this is like before the age of PCs, right? So personal computer was invented in 1984. the year I joined IIT.
Okay.
So IIT did not have PCs when I entered IIT, right? So we were all using mainframes.
Oh wow. Okay.
So that's why the second lucky thing happened to me was that, again, this is pure luck. That when I went to IIT, the one of my seniors who was, you know, two doors away from me. So he was in the final year, I was in the first year. And he was very, and he was a brilliant guy. He was like the top of his batch. And for some reason, he took a liking to me and he got me interested in programming.
Okay.
So and I just love programming. So the minute I got into IIT and I did my first semester, I did a course in very basic programming, some Fortran or something. But I was just hooked onto programming. It seemed like a little game to play. So while most of my friends were not interested in programming, or programming was just too new, unless you're a computer science graduate, it was not particularly a cool thing to do, right?
Right.
Electronics was probably maybe a little bit more cool to do than software programming. Plus, it was very hard to do, right? You had to do mainframes and punch cards. And so it was really like very crude and very, very crude and very, very difficult to do, right? Because you do your punch card, feed it to a mainframe, and then 6 hours later, you'll get like an error in your whatever.
Wow, okay.
So it was very painful to do. Of course, at that time, I didn't know anything different. But almost all through my 4 years of college, I was programming. So about 2-3 years in, we got some basic PCs, some very crude machines. But somehow I knew that, I mean, it was very clear to me that I knew that I'm not going to do chemical engineering and I'm going to do computer programming, right? That was also clear. And these two threads are very clear, that I love traveling and wanted to see places, and I like programming. Right. So when I exited IIT in 88, it was very clear to me that I'm going to switch to programming. So I never even applied for a chemical engineering job. I got a couple of campus placements for programming. But then I had an opportunity to go abroad. For further studies. And it was very clear to me I wanted to get a degree in programming. So I applied. I went to University of Southern California first. I couldn't get into any computer master's degree from undergrad. And also, I didn't have any scholarship or any way to fund it. So basically, I got a scholarship in chemical engineering. So I don't know why, but I got it.
Okay.
So I went there, but it was very clear that even in the first semester that I'm going to change, right? So literally I went to USC and shifted one semester later, right? My professors were pissed off, right? Because they expected me to finish the degree, but I was very clear, right? I'm going abroad to switch.
They continued to give you the scholarship, like that was not a problem.
Only for the first semester. I switched to a different college.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Right? I changed universities. And basically the first university that would offer me a scholarship, I was going to switch.
Okay.
Right. And I think I got one or maybe two offers, I don't remember. But this was another piece of luck that I ended up in the Northern California. I ended up in the Bay Area.
Wow. Okay.
My university was University of California in Santa Cruz, just in the Bay Area. So I was very interested in computer programming, and you know that was it. Right, and traveling. Now,
was it like a Silicon Valley thing at that time?
Not yet.
Okay.
Right. So this is again pre-internet. I'm talking about. Right. So there was no internet. Right. There were basic, I mean, obviously computers were there, but mostly like, you know, heavy duty machines. And so, but Silicon Valley was there. Right. So it was. Anyway, so went to grad school. But at grad school, already the entrepreneurship was very much a real thing at that time. Right. Because of Silicon Valley. Right. So because it was Silicon Valley, there were some startups. Right, Apple had, you know, was a very successful company, right? So there was the notion of startups were there, software, right? Microsoft was very successful, right? So startups, successful entrepreneurs, that thing was already there. And a few of my friends in the grad school, they wanted to start a company, and that was essentially became my first startup.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we started a company right out of grad school.
So how were you? So you got a scholarship which would have paid for your university fees, but how were you sustaining yourself? Because your parents would not have been able to send you money to survive.
Yeah. Parents had zero money. They didn't even have money to send me to buy a ticket, one-way ticket. So I had to take a loan to buy a one-way ticket.
Wow. Okay. From your relatives?
From a bank.
Oh, okay. Okay. Like, was it easy to get a loan like that, or like you hustled?
No. So I had to pledge my house or something.
Wow. Okay.
It's like some stupid 50,000 rupee loan. Yeah. So, I mean, 50,000 rupees was a lot of money at the time, but still.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how were you surviving in the US then?
So I did have a scholarship basic thing for the grad school. But this entrepreneurship was on the side, like in grad school.
Okay.
Yeah. So we were doing this company, we didn't know really what we were doing, but now in retrospect, but at that time it seemed like a cool idea. We were exploring various things. And along with my friends who were also in grad school. So when I finished grad school, I didn't have a green card or anything. So I couldn't do my startup on the side. So we kept the startup on the side and I joined a job. But the job was also in a startup, right? Okay. So it was a startup company and it was a good job. And luckily for me, the company went public in 2 years.
Oh, wow. Which company was this?
It was a company called, at that time, was called Digital Link. Right. It was a networking company.
Okay.
I was doing software there. And so this was like 1993 by the time I got my green card, luckily in 2 years. Okay. And the company went public in 2 years. Mm-hmm. Right. So I was doing my startup on the side. And then this company went public. Right? So that obviously gave me, I got my green card, so I could, I was free, right? I didn't need to be tied to a job.
Right.
So I quit the startup immediately. It took a 3 month break.
Did you get ESOPs and all?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So that obviously immediately put me in a good financial situation. Mm-hmm. Right.
That became like the seed capital, which you could kind of draw on.
Effectively, right. At least. So definitely I could fund myself. So when I sold that company, I took 3 months off. And again, sort of back to the travel theme. So I went to South America. For some reason, I had a fascination for travel, especially in Latin America. Even
this
now,
is after the Digital Link IPO,
after the Digital Link IPO, I got my green card, took 3 months off, right? And my startup was still going on. My partners were doing the work. I decided that I need to take some time off. So I took 3 months off, some of it friends, some of it solo. I did all kinds of stuff, hiked in the Andes and, went to Brazil. I learned Spanish in the meanwhile. So even now I speak Spanish pretty fluently.
Wow.
So I went to Brazil. I went everywhere, Chile, Argentina, Peru and Machu Picchu, all kinds of places, which in those days were still pretty exotic, nobody would travel there. So this was like 3 months off, which is good. When you're traveling by yourself, you really learn a lot and how to take care of yourself. Again, remember pre-internet. So it was not like you could, do booking.com and Airbnb and stuff like that, right? There was nothing.
Right.
No phone. So you're just by yourself.
Yeah.
And that was, so anyway, I came back and did my first startup. So to fast forward a little bit, we sold that startup.
So tell me about the startup. Like, what was the idea that you were executing in that? Like, and did it stay the same or did you pivot? And like,
we pivoted a lot, we went from we wanted to do a medical software originally because we knew a doctor. He had he wanted a software for his clinic.
Something like Practo.
Something like Practo, yeah. Like a very crude version of pre-internet fractal. But at that time, it was just too complicated. So we changed completely, and we went into basically software protection, anti-piracy software. Okay, and that's what we did. So that company was reasonably successful. We grew it. We went through a couple of acquisitions, and we ended up selling the company to a public company called Rainbow Technologies.
Okay.
So that was a good exit for all of us.
And this was bootstrapped.
I joined full time in 93. It took about 4 years, four years.
Okay. And this was bootstrapped.
This was bootstrapped. Bootstrapped.
Okay. So that must have been a pretty good exit.
That was a very good exit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So so the first one was a ESOP, right? Employee ESOP. The second, early employee. I was one of the early people at DigitalLink. The second one was an acquisition. So again, in the meantime, I had again done a lot of travel. I went to Africa, this, that. So somehow I got fascinated by Africa.
Okay.
This time. So after we sold the second company, I took a year off. And this was in 97.
Okay. Were you married by then?
Not yet.
Okay.
So I'm coming to that. Okay. So I took a year off, and I had this whole thing of going all the way from. So I started in Turkey, went all through the Middle East.
Okay.
You know, this is again, it was safe to travel in those days and everywhere, you know, Israel, Egypt, Jerusalem, everywhere. And then my idea was that I wanted to hitchhike across the Sahara. That was my objective.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, which even in those days was very, very hard thing to do, even without, you know, pre-terrorism, pre-everything, was a very hard thing to do.
Right.
So anyway, and internet had come on by this time, and I had posted on some news group saying this is what I wanted to do. One Dutch guy replied saying that, hey, you know, by the way, you can't really do hitchhike and all, but because there are, you know, there's no traffic there in that route. And it's a desert. You can't, you know, stand in the middle of the desert and put your thumb out. But he said, look, you know, a few of us have the same idea. So we're planning to buy like two or three SUVs in Holland. And we're planning to drive across, right? And then sell the SUVs in when we reach across the Sahara in a country called Senegal.
Okay.
Right. So we're going to plan to sell to Senegal. But you need to speak the language, so you have to learn French. So, which I ended up learning. So I learned French.
Wow.
Before I traveled.
Yeah.
There's zero English there. why don't you join us? So I said, cool, why not? You know, that sounds like a good idea. So I have like a year, so it's not like I was in a hurry to do anything. So and that's what I ended up doing. So it was me, five Dutch guys, and this another woman who was also European, but she'd been living in South Africa, right? Her name was Dana. His name was Rudy. There were six of us. So anyway, seven of us started in Amsterdam on a cold, rainy January morning. And pretty much we drove all the way from Amsterdam through Europe into Morocco. It was an interesting trip. Obviously, we were camping, and right, it was 6 weeks of, you know, six or eight weeks, I don't remember, of sort of being in the desert, right? So it's like you're camping, you're cooking, etc. But probably the most interesting thing that happened, even more than crossing the desert, was that Dana and I ended up falling in love, and we've been married for 20 years now.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's some story, huh? When people ask you how you met.
Yes. I usually, so don't like telling the story because, you know, after I tell the story, then, you know, the other stories kind of, other people don't like to tell their stories. But it was quite an interesting story, obviously, you know, with all kinds of adventures in the middle. But then after we met in Thing, I wanted to travel alone, not even with her. So I spent another 2-3 months alone in West Africa, which is one of the roughest places in the world to travel. It's hot, it's poor, you know, it's crazy.
West Africa includes which countries? Like
Senegal, Mali, okay. Gambia, you know, Burkina Faso. I mean, countries which are not like touristy countries, right? So this is not like Kenya, which I had been to before. That's what kind of gave me the taste of. So I'd been to Kenya, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and all those kind of places, which is somewhat touristy. This is like, there's no tourism. This is like just, you know.
Poverty.
Yeah, you're going to like the middle of Bihar. And, you know, you're traveling by yourself, by solo, right? Mm. Carrying all cash. There's no credit card. There's no, nothing works.
Right, okay.
Right. So I know.
Did you feel threatened ever during that trip?
Never.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I was really alone and, you know, you're like sleeping in railway stations. It was like really rough, right? Mm. Travel, right? Mm. You're, you know, in the middle of like nowhere.
Yeah,
right. And only French, right? There's no English, nothing, right? No language.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting, obviously. So by this time, obviously, my profile of taking risk was like very, very high. Like okay, let's go. You know, jumping, let's jump, right? It was kind of like that.
Yeah, when you can play with your life, then playing with career, playing with money, exactly. All is fairly secondary. Yeah.
Exactly. So then I came back to the Valley a year later, 98. And I did my my second own startup and the third startup, you know, if you include the...
So one question about Africa, like, was there like some sort of self-discovery, some insight, something which happened during that Africa trip?
There were several, in the sense that you know, when you're by yourself, you know, for a long time and you're dealing with like all kinds of unknowns, right? So you're pretty much sort of very much like into like, let's deal with it, right? And I can deal with anything, kind of. It was a little bit of that, right? Along the lines of what you said, you know, it's just, if I can take this, I can deal with anything.
Okay.
And also somewhat take life as it goes, right? It was a very dramatic set of events. I'm skipping a few events that happened also in the middle, but all kinds of crazy stuff happened.
Like what?
Right? By yourself in the desert, you know, all kinds of shit happens.
Hmm.
So you're very much, you know, resilient in some ways. I mean, I'm paraphrasing now, obviously. You know, 20 years.
What were some of the things that happened? Like,
oh, all kinds of stuff, right? I mean, you know, things would break down, right? I mean, I would be stuck in like a very remote place, right? Like, you know, like for example, you know, I was like kind of, I was alone. I was in a very small village. I mean, think of some tiniest village you can think of, right? And I had to go and cross the border of a country. I don't remember which one anymore. So I was going from one country to another, but basically one village on this side to another village on the other side. And the distance is not much. It was like some, you know, 30 kilometers or something. But I can't walk it. So I had to like sort of travel. And there are no buses or anything. But they had these sort of, you know, what we also have in India, right? This little pickup trucks kind of thing, right? If you go to real small places, they'd be like, there won't be buses, but there'd be a pickup truck.
Like a Mahindra.
Mahindra type of thing. And the way it would work is basically they would, when they fill up, they go.
Hmm. Okay.
Right? So I was waiting, for example, you know, then there's no timing, right? You show up in a tea shop at 8 o'clock and you sit and wait, right? And people start showing up. So I remember one thing where I was like sitting at 8 o'clock and I was waiting and waiting. I wanted to go to the other place by evening, by afternoon, ideally, right? It was only 30 kilometers. But after like, you know, 3 hours, right? There are like 3 people.
Okay.
And that guy is like, I'm not leaving until there are like at least 10 people.
Yeah.
So I'm like, guys, you know, it's not going to happen, right? Yeah. Like, why don't we all pitch in and pay for like the 10?
Yeah.
And everybody was like shocked. I mean, obviously the amount is a very tiny amount, right? We're talking about some pittance. And I had sold the company, so I had the money, but obviously these guys have like no money. And I also didn't want to like open up my wad of cash, and you know, that would be not like a good thing to do. Anyways, at 1 o'clock, you know, there's nobody showing up and all these guys are lighting fires and like planning to settle down for the night. And guys, like, what are you doing? You know, let's go. So finally, you know, the poor people are there. Anyway, I end up personally paying for everybody. So anyway, in the middle, I'm like, you know, I'm like, okay, well, you know, screw you guys. I'm going to walk, right? And everybody's like, that's stupid. Like, what are you doing? So I'm like, you know, fuck you. I'm going to walk. So I start walking. You know, after a few kilometers, obviously, it's like a desert. I'm like, okay, that's like a dump to do. They're like, yeah, I told you. So, anyway, a few hours of this, and I sort of pay the remaining fare for everybody else. I said, I'll pay. So they're all like shocked. They're saying, what are you doing? You know, you're like crazy. You should not be doing this. And I said, we have to go, right? We have to cross the border. So anyway, we go to the border. And the border, that guy is like, who are you? Because I have an Indian passport, and they've never seen an Indian passport. I mean, it's not like a, you know, passport or something. Anyway, all kinds of crazy stuff. So we cross the border, we go to the other side, and obviously the other side, there's nobody else either. It's the same crowd that has to go to the other village. And they are like, okay, there's nobody who's going to come. So let's just stay here for the night. I'm like, are you crazy? No, we can't stay here. There's like nothing, right? I have like nothing to sleep on. And like we're in the middle of like nowhere. Another like long argument. Anyway, so, you know, the same argument, same people. I'm like, guys, this time why don't you pay? Because there's nothing is going to happen. We're here. And they're like, that's okay. Now, what's the big deal in life, right? Like, what's the hurry? They're all don't understand like why you are going to the other village, because there's nothing in that village, right? It's not like, you know, you're going to see Niagara Falls or something on the other side, right? You're just like going there. Right. So anyway, so I mean, you get like a number of crazy things like this, right, where you're dealing with situations. But I mean, if you view it like as a sense of adventure, then it's an adventure. Hmm. Right? If you view like, man, I have to go somewhere, then it's like a, you know, massive annoyance. Right.
Okay. Or so like that perspective shift happened of
exactly
not focusing on the destination, but the journey.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, literally in this case. So, I mean, and you know, and the whole of West Africa is kind of like that, because there is no destination, right? Even 20 years later, if someone, people ask me, where should I go, right? You know, in that place, tell me like a spot, right? There is no spot. I mean, I can maybe Timbuktu is one place, but there is no other place I can tell you, right? Which is like beautiful, or, you know, there's like a mountain or a waterfall or market, anything. It was, I mean, there are a lot of markets and stuff, but it was all right. It's just there. Right? It was like a journey where there's no particular destination, but the experience is the effect. Anyway, a little bit like that. So anyway, I came back to the US, this was 98. So by 98, of course, you know, the startup boom was full steam in the valley,
right?
The dot coms. It was a dot com sort of era, so obviously I wanted to roll the dice and start a company, but I didn't have an idea in mind, right? And there were sort of lots of sort of groups of people without any idea, like wanting to start companies, right? I just want to start a company kind of thing, so. There was one such group, which is basically one of them was my close friend and another couple of guys. And we said, okay, let's brainstorm ideas, right? So we'll sit in a coffee shop and, you know, like, you know, why don't we sell fridge doors? You know, why don't we sell like whiteboards online? Everything was online, right? It'd be like,
right. E-commerce.
It was e-commerce of some sort, right? Like waterbottles.com, you know. People are already selling socks, so that idea was taken. You know, you could, you know, sell puppets, you know, just literally like, think of something and then .com, right? Immediately go and search for the domain. And so obviously most of the ideas were like really stupid. But what happened, I think, after a few months of this was that the pressure of wanting to start a company became too much. right? Fairly smart guys, two other. So I was from IIT, two other guys from IIT. One guy had gone to IIT, went to Harvard, right? MBA from McKinsey. And these guys had all, the three of them had also sold a company, just like I had done.
Okay.
So we were all like second time entrepreneurs, you know, fairly, you know, loaded from that financial standpoint, right? Very pedigreed, right? So we could all attract, right? You know, we could walk into VC's offices also.
Right.
But we didn't have an idea. So anyway, 6 months later, we kind of, there's a lot of pressure to start a company. Like, what are you guys doing? You know, like, you can only brainstorm like so many ideas. Like, let's start something, you know, like that. So we finally came up with an idea, which was, the company was called iSelect. Okay, iSelect was the name of the company. And the idea was essentially what is now like Urban Clap in India.
Okay.
Right. That was the basic idea. But this is all in the US, more Silicon Valley. So anyway, so long story short, we did some seed funding, but we shut down the company in about 6 months.
Why was that?
Yeah. So there were a lot of reasons. So the idea itself was probably way ahead of its times at that time. There are a lot of sort of holes in the idea. Again, I'm giving you sort of a retrospect kind of story. But the bigger problem was that we couldn't get along as a team. Right? It was a little bit of an arranged marriage, right? We had some friends, but I was not really close to all of them. I knew only one of them really well. And it was a combination of the idea not like catching on fire and the fact that, you know, we couldn't get along as a team. Yeah. So it was pretty much a total disaster. So all the seed funding was gone. And we had to shut the company down, right? Because we couldn't work together.
Okay.
And in my book, that's kind of one of the worst ways to waste your investor money. And as an investor later on, I'm like super sensitive to that point, right? One thing, you know, you tried and you failed, right? Business did not take off. Customers did not like your product. There are a lot of reasons to fail, which are in my mind, quote unquote, legitimate, right? But what is not cool is that you guys can't get along and you didn't know that before.
Right.
Right. And you discover it like 6 months later.
Was it like no shared vision? Everyone had a different vision for what to do? Or was it like...
Different vision.
Was there like a CEO designate who could pull everyone together?
There was a CEO designate, but we didn't like him.
Okay.
That was the problem. Otherwise, I think we could have probably managed. It was just like a bad dynamic, right?
Too much testosterone.
And this is going to work became like toxic. So basically, you know, just it could, like, you know, it's your company, but you just don't feel like going to work. And by the time we had to hire a team, there were like some 30 to 40, I don't remember how many people, but 30 plus people for sure, probably 50 people, right? So like, who all believed in our like vision that we sold them. And we couldn't get along. Even as we were hiring, we knew we couldn't get along with each other, right? And again, I'm not blaming one person on this. It's probably, you know, I was also somewhat immature in all of this. But a huge learning, obviously, is not to do that again, ever. So that was like a really bad experience. But in some sense, it was good that one of the best decisions I probably made was to shut down the company or want to shut down the company, right? Because to stick around and do that for years would have been like a personal disaster and probably a professional disaster as well. So so the right thing to do was to actually shut that company down, which is what we did. And in the meanwhile, there was another group, which I was telling you, groups of people ideating. Another group of people actually had an idea, which seemed much more interesting, and a very close friend of mine from IIT. He was one of them, and a couple other guys. So they had been ideating on an. They also, you know, didn't have like a preset passion, right? But they also wanted to start a company. All the three of them had gone to Harvard, and my friend went to IIT and went to Stanford and went to Harvard. So my friend's name was Shripati Acharya, and I liked the guys, right? I liked all of them. And I had just come from experience of like having bad founders. So I really liked them, and I broadly liked the idea. I did not do too much research on it, but I said, you know what, let's do this company. Okay. So this bad company experience lasted maybe a year until I joined, we started this company.
Which was Snapfish.
So, yeah. So this company obviously is a huge success. You heard of Snapfish, right? So there were four of us founders. I just got in. I mean, they had come up with the basic idea and I just came in, right? At that time. So moving to office, San Francisco. And this was like a real .com, right? So we raised like some $40 million, $30 or $40 million on a PowerPoint.
What was the original idea of Snapfish that you had in your deck based on which you raised the funds?
Sure. So the pitch deck basically opened with saying, kill Kodak. That was our opening line. Remember, we were very cocky, Silicon Valley type of people. The idea, so this is the digital cameras had not yet come. Yeah, there was internet, but no digital cameras. It was the first cameras just started to come out, and the camera was like $3,000, right? So Kodak was like the king. Kodak had been around for like, 100 plus years, right? And Kodak, basically what it does is Kodak sells film. Kodak sells film cameras. Kodak sells the chemicals to process the film, and then the paper to process the chemicals. And you get prints, right, in photo stores and retail stores and so on and so forth. And repeat, right? So you can take more photos. So they were like, photos means Kodak, right? The Kodak moment. Right? Right. They were like a company, iconic company, Eastman Kodak. But what had just happened was that digital cameras were just starting to come in, but it was still very much a toy, right? It was very high-end. The quality was very poor, right? The best camera you could get was like 1 megapixel.
Wow, okay.
For like $3,000, some absurdly expensive camera. But the industry was kind of talking about it. Hey, you know, digital cameras. But obviously, nobody took it seriously.
The way people are talking about self-driving cars today, in a way.
Exactly. It was very much like self-driving cars now. Right? Like exotic, you know, yeah, someday. Sounds like it should happen logically, but, right, and like, you know, who knows? Like, there'll be other issues, you know, memory, you know, this, that. Everybody had, like, questions. But because it was a dot-com boom, there are already like 120 startups, which were all taking photos from the digital camera and uploading it. Right? So even these few hobby people who bought the digital camera, right? So they would take the photos and these guys would upload the photos, right? And then you can share it and so on and so forth. So our idea was, hey, you know, eventually digital camera might happen, but today people have film cameras. So why don't we take people's film rolls, digitize them, like scan the film, and then put it on the internet, right? And then they can share them. And, you know, they can still use photos or print or whatever, but we are bringing them digital.
Okay.
That was our angle to this. As we did the research, we realized that the people who actually take photos in America were women.
Okay.
Yeah. And not only women, but mothers.
Okay. For the kids.
Right? So pretty much young mothers are the ones who take photos. Right. I mean, there's also other categories like travelers and so on and so forth. but the ones who took the most number of photos, because travel you do once a year or something, right? Vacation. But the ones who take in terms of volume of photos taken is the young mothers. So we decided that the target audience was young mom. The business idea was to let them take photos on film, and then we would digitize it and put it back on the internet.
From where they could download it and share it.
And then they could download it, but we'd also send them the rolls, the film back, and the prints. So they have a copy of that. And then they could share it. So this was basically the core of the idea. Now, the irony thing, of course, was that there are four sort of Indian guys, right? Two of them from India, and two others who are like Indian Americans. And our target audience was like some, white mom.
Yeah, right.
And we were all single at that time as well. Most of us are just married or something. So we had like no idea what this mom was. But the business was very clear. It was not about us. Because we were all sort of business guys, especially three guys with an MBA, they were very clear. We're not the customer. The customer is somebody else. Right? We're not designing something that we would use. We're designing somebody else. Somebody else will use. So again, fast forward a little bit. A lot of stuff happened, but obviously the film cameras died much faster than we thought. So 1998, there were hardly anybody with film cameras. By 2001, everybody was using digital cameras, right? Because electronics really, brought the price down dramatically. It was still expensive. It was still like $1,500 for a two megapixel camera. But digital cameras sort of started taking off, right? Because China was manufacturing it, and it was just an electronic manufacturing problem.
Right, right,
But we were one. So then the .com crash happened. So anyway, a lot of stuff happened. Obviously, in 2001, right? When we launched the product, personally for me, I had twin babies.
Right? Okay, so you married Dana.
Like 10 days. So I married Dana. We had like twin daughters, right in the middle of my startup. Super stressful. And then 9/11 happened, right? 9/11 nearly killed our business because, we were still film-based at that point, and all the rolls of film was coming from a factory. The scanning was done at a factory in Washington, D.C. And there was this anthrax scare where basically they wanted to put all these X-ray machines in all the... So that somebody was shipping anthrax. It's like a poison. And the government wanted to basically... This is immediately after 9/11. Mm-hmm. Right? There was like a little mini scare that somebody was mailing poison. And so the U.S. Postal Service wanted to like put X-ray machines on all the thing, which would have basically killed our business.
Okay, the X-ray would have spoiled the negatives.
Exactly. Okay. So anyway, there were lots of things like this. But 9/11 itself, all the .com bust happened, right? But luckily we had raised the money before, right? So almost all our competitors went out of business.
Okay.
Because they were too reliant on digital cameras, which had not yet taken off. And we were just because we were using film and we kind of survived, we were able to sort of survive to tell the story. And then when the digital cameras took off, right, we kind of morphed the business into a digital printing business. Like basically you would upload your pictures and take prints.
Okay.
So 20 years later, so in 2005, we got bought by Hewlett Packard. So for about $300 million. And in the middle, and then we started also powering, white labeling our site to Walmart, for example.
Okay.
So even today, Walmart Photos is powered by Snapfish. Walgreens is powered by Snapfish. So, and in addition to our own business, so Snapfish.com, you can go check out Snapfish.com. It's one of the very few websites that was started in the year 2000 that you can still type in. www.snapfish.com and then you'll see a website. Right? Almost no brand existed, no brand continued. Companies did not continue.
Right.
Most of the companies died. So it's one of them, I'm super proud of the fact that I started a company and 20 years later I can tell you to go to a website.
Right. Yeah.
Right. that is still doing it. Snapfish is still a very big, big business. It's a little bit of a niche play now, right? But you can go to snapfish.com.
Why the decision to sell to HP?
They offered us a lot of money.
Okay. But like, what were the dynamics around that? Like, if you like thought that this can become like a $1 billion unicorn or something, you may have felt that this was not enough money, or you know, like what was the...
We were not sure. We were not sure that it would become a $1 billion unicorn. Mainly because we were not sure if people would print forever.
Okay.
So we didn't know what the behavior would be. Right? And so it happened that the people stopped printing so much. They do other things. It's still a good business. It's a little bit of a niche business.
Okay.
And HP, which was the one big in printing, came and offered, made a good offer.
Right.
And we thought it was fine.
Yeah, for HP, it fit into their product line. Okay. Got it.
So, we started, essentially launched the company in April 2000, right? Started in 99. Right. So I stayed on. And my personal career had a big switch when HP bought us. So I used to be a techie. I was, I was a programmer and all of that. And I was a CTO until HP bought us.
Okay.
And then I switched and I decided I wanted to be a business guy. So I personally went and started Snapfish in Australia. Then in a number of countries in Europe, we did an acquisition in Europe.
Okay.
So at one point I was managing Snapfish International in about 20 countries.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd launched like multiple countries. Again, it sort of goes a little bit with my personal passion of traveling. My wife is like an even bigger traveler than I am.
Okay.
So there's like always that thread of adventure, going into the unknown, right? And my wife and I would take kids and drag our kids everywhere, you know, from Cuba to, you know, all kinds of crazy places in Africa and everywhere, right? So even though we had like newborn kids and, you know, young, you know, didn't matter, even though I was doing a startup. So it kind of was a very big part of life as I go along. Like, I had also got interested in other passions. Like, I started getting into trekking. I do a lot of scuba diving at that time.
Okay.
So a fair amount of that kind of skiing. I still ski a lot. Mm-hmm. Right. So a fair amount of other kind of interests, which in sort of outdoors, besides just, you know, doing a startup. But all of this are kind of, you know, intertwined in some ways, in the sense of taking risks, going out there and putting yourself out there a little bit.
Right.
In 2007, I was running the international business. The travel was getting hard. And by this time, I had lived in the US for 17 years. My wife is European, so she had been there only for like 7 years. And my dad just passed away a year back due to brain. He had a brain tumor in 2006. And in 2007, we decided, hey, why not move to India for a couple of years? So obviously, you know, our kids were 6 years old. You know, I had all my friends and my life was obviously in the US, right? I mean, I had some family here. My mother was here, but my mother was alone. I thought, okay, chalo, you know, maybe it's a good time to spend a couple of years in India. And that's what we did.
Didn't you feel it would be a compromise for your kids? I mean, growing up in US versus growing up in India.
Yeah, so when we came, first we thought we'll stay for a couple of years. Right? We thought, okay, chalo, it's like they're young enough that it'll be a little bit of an adventure for them. So we moved to Bangalore in 2007. And it was very complicated because my wife is not Indian. And obviously, I never lived in Bangalore. I'd been to Bangalore a couple of times, but never lived. I'm not a Bangalorean.
Right.
And there was really no particular reason for me to be in Bangalore, in the sense that, you know, HP, by the time we were part of HP, HP didn't care, you know, where you want to be. So they were just kind of humoring me. They said, all right, chalo, if you want to be in Bangalore, you can be in Singapore, you can be in Bangalore. It's not like they wanted me to go.
Right.
So we just thought it'll be a little bit of an adventure, chalo, why not try something? Right? We live in the valley, you know, I knew how Silicon Valley was like. And So my friends all thought and still think that I'll, you know, I'll be back in a couple of years.
Okay.
So anyway, long story short, obviously 2 years has become, you know, probably going to come to 20 years. So it's not quite, it's about 15, 12, 14 years now.
Was it hard to kind of settle into India after seeing the best in class lifestyle, so to say?
Yeah, so look, we lived in Bangalore, you know, in gated community. It was not that hard from that point of view.
Right, right.
And professionally, I was still mostly running a global business, so I didn't have to interact too much with, you know, getting my hands dirty, local scene and so much. So the first couple of years was like a really honeymoon in some ways. But what really clinched it for us was the kids really loved it.
Okay. Okay.
The kids loved the school. We made some good friends. In 2009, late 2009, I had the good fortune of meeting Nandan, Nandan Nilakani. I've been at Snapfish for 10 years now. And I built the business, and the business was doing very well, right? We were doing about $1 billion in GTV, and about, you know, everybody was happy. It was a good situation. It was growing like crazy. We had launched in 20 countries. So it was kind of like a good time. Nandan, so somebody had through the Bangalore connection had told me that Nandan Nilakani is launching this biometric ID program, right? Manmohan Singh had just given him a cabinet position.
Right.
To go do something with a biometric ID, but it was very vague. Literally, that was the mandate. That's it, right? Biometric ID. Nandan, being who he is, you know, super charismatic, he got together a bunch of very, very bright people, including people like Pramod Verma, who was the chief technology officer of pretty much iSpirit, you know, of UPI, right? He built the GST network.
Okay.
Shrikant Nadmuni was amazing guy. So a number of like really bright people, what 5-10 people. And he had already gotten, which I didn't know at that time. I knew them a little bit later, but I went to his house to say, hey, you know, I've been back. I've done all of this. Like, you know, what should I do in life types?
Okay.
So I walked out of his house with a resignation letter to HP in hand.
Okay.
So he convinced me that like I should not be like wasting my life and I should like do something for the country. So I quit HP, which was crazy, you know, like a 7-figure salary and, you know, all kinds of perks and obviously in a, you know, growing business, to join Aadhaar. Aadhaar was really a startup in every sense of the word. We didn't even have an office, right? So
okay.
Shrikant had rented an apartment in Bangalore, and you know the, but it was a bunch of amazing people, including Mr. you know R.S. Sharma, who is like the chairman of Try right now.
Okay.
Book on this topic. You know, I met him on his first day. Like he walked into an apartment, thinking like, "What is going on here? It's like we're running a government. It's supposed to be a government program, and you guys are like, what are you doing?" Very Delhi, a bunch of very, very bright officers from Delhi and a bunch of bright people from Bangalore, right? It was like a, you know, but yin, you know, it was like, you know, yin and yang in some ways.
Okay.
So this was the birth of Aadhaar. And literally in the first meeting, Nandan basically looked at everybody and said, we're going to do, you know, 50 crore Aadhaar in 5 years. He just picked a number, 50 crores in 5 years. And this is before anything. There was no organization, no government, nothing, no staffing, you know, no technology, nothing. And everybody looked at him thinking he must be crazy. So that was the next phase, which was, again, I was very lucky to be a part of.
You were here as like an unpaid volunteer or was it like a job?
Unpaid volunteer.
Okay.
No job.
Most of the people from the tech side were like unpaid volunteers.
Yeah, we're all unpaid volunteers. So that was Nandan's genius in like convincing a bunch of people to quit their jobs and become unpaid volunteers for the government. The government didn't quite understand. They still don't understand. They think, why did you want to do this? You must have some ulterior motive because people don't do that.
Right.
But it was difficult because, you know, the cultures are very difficult. Working styles are very different. But I did definitely get grounded to India pretty quickly. And some amazing entrepreneurs came out of this. A company called Healthify, who I sit on the board of. They're called Tushar. He was part of my team. So the bunch of very bright people who are all passionate for a cause, right? So kind of charged up. It was like a country building kind of a thing. But it was definitely for me a very grounding experience of getting out of the bubble and traveling to Chhattisgarh and in all kinds of remote places everywhere, mm-hmm. right?
Tell me about how that idea got shaped up in that 1 year which you spent over there.
I spent a couple of years there. I spent about 2 years there.
Okay.
There are many, many threads here, but again, I was a small part in a great project. So my role was, I was a volunteer, but as help out wherever I can, kind of a role. But I mean, the idea was shaped up by it was a collective effort from extremely dedicated, IAS officers who have never seen any startups entrepreneur work like that before or after, who work for nothing. And, it's not like they had any personal gain out of this. And a bunch of very, very bright people. Essentially, everybody shaped together from, from the idea of, should we use fingerprints? Should we use DNA? Should we use, how do you create a unique ID? Right? How do you store it? How do you, should it be done by an agency? Should it be done by a private company? Who should run it? Who should manage it? How do you develop software? Right? I mean, it's just like everything, right? How do you do RFPs?
But was it clear that you were building a platform rather than just an ID? Like this would be something.
Yes, it was very clear. I was building a platform. Nandan, okay. It's crystal clear on the vision of it, right? And I've never met anybody like him in my life. In terms of his vision, in terms of his dedication, in terms of his work ethic. I mean, he would work from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., deal with minor, from detailed minutia of tech issues to policy to home ministry to, all kinds of stuff. Right? The breadth in launching something like this, it was really like a breathtaking audacity, honestly, to be able to think that you can go and issue a biometric ID electronically, mm-hmm. right? Remember, this 3G had not even come in yet, right? 3G was just coming in. Mm-hmm. And people thought there'll be no network connectivity, what are you talking about, online ID, right? And he was like, don't worry, right? We are building for the future, right? It will come, right? So it was just amazing, the number of strategic decisions, tactical decisions, the range of decisions that was made. So I think that was, to me, it was a very life-changing experience in a lot of ways. Also to sort of get reoriented to India, because I've been out of India for 20 years at this point.
Right.
From the days of running around and doing market research and driving around buses and walking around to the new India, right? The whole generation had grown up,
right?
Post-liberalization, right? People who didn't know what I was talking about, right? They couldn't relate to anything that I grew up with, and still don't. But it was different. I loved it personally. I thought it was a much better place to live and grow up than what I had grown up with.
Right.
It was really a new country in a lot of ways, and a serious upgrade, I would say. So it was really fascinating how the next generation thing. Most of the volunteers were very young. They were like 20, right? So it was very fascinating how a whole set of people, how their assumptions were very different, their ambitions were very different. And interacting with all of them basically gave me the thread of wanting to do what to do next. And so this is where my co-founder from Snapfish, the guy I told you about, Shripati, who was also one of my close friends, he had also moved to India along with me. He was my neighbor. He also did. He was also at UID with me. At Adhadar, and he and I, along with Sanjay Swami, who was also our neighbor, who was also a volunteer at Adhar, we came up with the idea of starting a venture capital fund. So the fund is now called Prime Ventures. At that time, it was called Angel Prime.
Okay.
And so Prime today is the largest probably seed fund in India.
Okay.
About $120-130 million AUM. And at that time, the idea was, you know, we knew that there'll be a bunch of exciting startups which would come from India. But having done startups, et cetera, we wanted to sort of be, you know, somewhat deeply involved, not only as investors, but also sort of help the entrepreneurs as well. We felt that that's what the entrepreneurial ecosystem needed. And that was the genesis of MoneyTap. Genesis
Angel
of Prime.
Right. Prime Ventures.
Hmm. Prime Ventures. Hmm. So we raised money from a number of Silicon Valley people, including people like Jerry Yang, who had started Yahoo.
Okay.
And we did a bunch of companies from 2012 to 2015.
Hmm. Can you explain to me how a VC works from the VC's perspective? Like, I believe there's like fund one, fund two, fund three, and all that. So, right. So how does that happen? Like, you create one fund with a certain objective and a certain money which is in your account, or is it like when you want to deploy, then that money comes in? Like, how does it work? Like,
good question. So the way it works is that there is something called fund one, fund two, etc. So the investment thesis, as you call it, like what are you going to invest? Are you going to invest in technology? Are you going to invest in sort of nonprofits? Are you going to invest in like clean energy? You know, you can pick whatever charter it is. And that usually doesn't change across funds. So you have an idea. Prime, for example, is to invest in early stage startups, right? And be sort of very heavily involved in the growth of the startup. As opposed to, for example, invest a little bit of money in a lot of startups, right? But not be so involved. That's another thesis. Again, there's nothing right or wrong, but everybody has to pick a thesis.
Right.
It's called an investment thesis. But other than so that stays across multiple funds. But typically you raise fund one, which is our fund two, the first fund, with a bunch of what they call LPs. LPs are limited partners. See, these are people overriding a check. They could be funds, they could be endowments, they could be family offices, there could be a number of people, right? So they essentially will write a check and the money sits in your bank.
Okay.
They commit to writing a check. Okay, they make a commitment.
Okay.
And it's a pretty strong commitment.
Hmm. Hmm.
So, and then you can call on the commitment saying, hey, you committed, you know, write me a check now. So typically you kind of call for every few months or every 6 months.
Okay. Based on opportunities that you identify where you want to invest in.
But not like every opportunity. You'll have a little bit of a reserve, but not too much reserve. There's no point having money and sitting in the bank. Yeah, that's generally considered bad practice, right? You call approximately when it's necessary, but not in the last minute.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. But do you call proportionately from all the LPs or you pick and choose? Okay, let's call from...
No. All the, proportionally from all
the
LPs.
Okay.
So, and the money comes to your bank and then you write a check from that company. So that each fund is a company in some ways. You write the money from that company into the company you want to invest.
The fundraise itself is like a sales activity where you have to sell your ability to identify startups.
Yes, exactly correct.
Okay. And do you put in your own money also? And like how much of...
You need to put in a small amount of your money.
Okay.
So that's how broadly it works. And it's fairly established. So there is no, for an industry which is innovation focused, there is no innovation here. This is a very standard formula almost. Right? What you take, what commission you get, all of that is very standard. It's very conservative. They don't change that very
much. So what does the partners of the VC, what do they get like if they do a good job?
So again, this is no secret. It's very common. So the typical is what they call 2 and 20. So if you raise, let's say, $100 million fund, you get 2% a year in what they call management fees.
Okay.
So this is for the salaries you pay the partners and office and any marketing activity you need to do.
Yeah, analysts and all that, yeah.
Analysts and et cetera, exactly. Right? Paying your office and all of that. So that's usually 2% of the fund, okay? And 20% is what they call carry. So carry is, let's say you invest $100 million and you get like a jackpot and, you know, invest in a Paytm or something and SoftBank buys you or whatever, something, you have an IPO or whatever, something good happens. So let's say the 100 million becomes 300 million. So first of all, you have to return the 100 million first.
Right.
You took. Out of the remaining 200 million, you typically get 20%.
Okay.
Hmm. Okay. And that's shared amongst partners.
Hmm. Okay. Okay. Got it.
GP, they call it.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so it's fairly standard structures, 2 and 20.
Hmm.
Across the world, almost. It might become 1%. If it's a very large fund, it might be 1%, but it's broadly in that range.
Hmm. Okay. And what were some of the companies that you were funding, and, you know, like any thesis you developed based on those years of investing in companies and seeing what's working and what's not?
Yeah. So we invested in a number of companies. So there's a company called EasyTap, which is a payment company. Company called Happy, which is also into fintech. It's a company called Nimble, which is now called Waggle. There are a number of companies. In the very first fund, we didn't. The world was always moving towards fintech, so there was like a little bit of a waiting on fintech, and that was sort of what got me interested in fintech. In looking at this, I was very intrigued by what was happening in the finance industry. So after 2-3 years in the fund, I sort of felt that there was a very big opportunity in fintech. Right. And so after the fund one, I left the fund. Right. So I'm not a partner in fund two, for example.
Okay. Okay.
And I started MoneyTap. Okay. So MoneyTap is the next phase of the journey.
Hmm.
Again, sort of somewhat very unusual thing to do because, you know, if you are, I mean, I was close to 50 at that time, 49.
Hmm. Hmm. Hmm.
You don't start a company and when you don't need to.
Right. Right.
It's not like a, you know, drive to make money or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was and this fund itself was doing really well.
Mm.
Prime was doing really well. I was with my best friends, right? It was really good setup. But I sort of felt like I had like one more adventure left in my career.
Okay. Okay.
Mm. And this opportunity, it seemed like a interesting opportunity. But I also sort of knew that, you know, given my co-founder experience in the past, et cetera, that I needed to have the right set of founders because this was going to be a long-term play.
Okay.
Right. It was going to be like a 10, 20 year kind of a play.
Okay.
So luckily for me, I met, Kunal and Anuj, two co-founders who had just exited a company, and I was sitting on the board of one of Anuj's brother's company.
Okay.
So I had some idea about who they were and what they were doing. They were really smart guys. And I had sort of a basis of an idea about what is now MoneyTap.
Hmm.
But it was not fully formed yet.
Hmm.
And we had not started a company or anything.
Hmm.
But I told my partners at Prime that I'm leaving to start this. Of course, they want to fund it. They're still a big investor in MoneyTap.
Okay.
So that's how sort of the next chapter started, which is basically MoneyTap.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? So MoneyTap.
The original idea that you had in your mind?
Yeah. So the original idea is pretty close to the idea that we still have right now. Is basically, I'd done a whole bunch of, because from my other days, I'd done a bunch of studies and I was like looking at a bunch of data. A few things are very clear. Obviously, in 2015, when we incorporated the company, you know, Jio we knew was coming at some point of time, right? With the high bandwidth. So network speed and all, we knew that would not be an issue. And if you recall, in 2013, it was a major issue, right?
Mm, yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, we were having edge network and 3G and it was expensive and it was slow and nobody had broadband at home. And it was like the world was not there. But because in my time in Aadhaar, I'd gotten to meet a number of these, you know, the CEO of Airtel, a number of people like that, right? We knew what the plans were. Like they were, you know, laying fiber everywhere in the country. So even though today your life kind of was bad, we knew that this will change. Right? So much fiber is being laid, you know, that this will change. Right? Plus, already the other countries had gotten there. And so we knew that we would have not those issues. But we did know. So with that, and also the credit bureaus were becoming very stronger. So I had met some of them as well.
Okay.
Right? So we knew that we could use data.
Hmm.
And we knew that credit card was underpenetrated in India severely. Right? At that time, there were like some 15 million credit cards in India, 20 million maybe. Yeah, even fewer people using credit cards. Credit card interest rates were exorbitant, still are exorbitant.
Right.
So the idea was that, and but yet credit card is the most popular product in the world financially by like a mile, right? If you go around the world and say, what is the most successful consumer product, financial product? It's a credit card, like hands down, right? It's an ecosystem. Giant companies have been built on it, right? From Visa and MasterCard to everybody else. But in India, it didn't make sense that it was poorly penetrated. So we knew that there'll be a mobile version of a credit card of some sort, right? We knew UPI was coming because, again, the connection with Aadhaar and everything. So we knew it was coming, right? We didn't know whether it'll come like, you know, 6 months later or 12 months later, but we knew it'll come like in the next 3 years, right? It was like that. And we knew bandwidth would be very available. But other than that, it's not like I had some proprietary knowledge of UPI or something, right? It's not like I had, those are all open, public, whatever everybody else knew, I also knew. But we knew that these trends were like in the right direction. And the idea was to provide sort of flexible credit to consumers. Okay, that was the idea. Because that's what a credit card does. It provides like a flexible credit. So Kunal, Anuj and I, we interviewed probably over 1,000 customers before incorporating the company. Right, we would stand in bus stops and malls and talk to people. Right, go to textile factories and a bunch of things, and say, "Well, what do you want?" And out of that came the idea that on an app, if you can fairly easily evaluate somebody for credit, and then if you give a line of credit, right, which is kind of a credit limit that you could use very flexibly, you could use borrow for 3 months, or you could borrow for 3 years. You could pay in EMIs. You could borrow 5,000 rupees, or you could borrow 50,000 rupees, or you could, right? As long as we could provide some reasonable interest rate, very flexible, you could use it like a swipe in a card in a machine, or you could use it as cash, right? So, or you could use it as UPI later on, that came later, right? As long as you provide flexible ways of spending money, flexible ways of borrowing money, and flexibility in repaying, right? For a small ticket, not like 5 lakhs or 10 lakhs, but like our average today is about 1 lakh.
Okay.
Credit limit. Right? And within that, people borrow like 10,000, 50,000, 20,000. Average borrowing disbursal is about 30,000. So that's how MoneyTap works. It's an app. You can download it. Available in like 8 languages. And once you get qualified for a limit, then you don't need to use it if you don't want it. To borrow money. But whenever you want, you press a button and the money is there in your bank account immediately. That's the idea.
Okay.
So the idea, it's and very fortunately for us, we met some really bright bankers. We met RBL Bank, which is a terrific bank, banking partner, because you need Indian financials, you need a bank as well to back you up.
Right,
and we met one of the probably I would say to even today one of the best bankers I've ever met in my life. At RBL Bank.
RBL also works with a lot of startups, fintech startups. I think Happy also with RBL.
RBL is very innovative from that point of view. So again, we were sort of lucky to meet them, and especially meet one of the best brains, and some of the ideation gelling came from them as well, right? So which also validated saying that it's real, right? Because we didn't know anything about the finance industry. None of us are from the industry.
Right.
So it was kind of a marriage between banking and tech. And to this day, we are probably one of the most successful partners for RBL in terms of startup. And we show up in their annual reports. So we have excellent relationship with them even now after 5 years. It's very hard to make a work with a bank also. It's not easy for a startup to work with a bank, right? It's a very different
country.
So 5 years out, so we launched the product about 4 years ago. The product is obviously a huge success. We have disbursed more than $500 million of money, of loans.
Okay. And like, is this your own money, or do you like further pass on the leads to various banks, or like how do you disburse this money?
So we don't pass on the leads. It's not our money. We manage the customer experience, but the loans agreement is signed with we are the enablers.
Okay.
Yeah, the loan agreement is signed with the bank or the NBFC. Now we have our own NBFC license as well. So,
okay.
So now we also lend some of our money.
Right? Okay. Okay.
So depending on the algorithm will determine who's the lender.
Like,
whether it's a bank.
Would have only been RBL till now, right? Or
no, RBL is a major bank lender, but you have a number of people now, number of NBFCs, etc.
Okay. Okay. So each NBFC has a certain risk profile basis which
correct.
You match them with the customer. Okay.
Effectively, right. Yeah.
But so once a customer is matched to an NBFC, then that customer, whether he takes another 50,000 or pays back, or that whole relationship is with that NBFC in terms of the credit limit increasing, going down and all that, except it happens through your app.
It happens through our app. We are the conduit. Hmm. They are the legal entity.
Hmm. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, we're just the enablers and the conduits.
Okay. So how did you, when you launched it initially, how did you do the customer acquisition? I mean, the supply side, obviously, you found RBL as one major partner, and which you grew with other NBFC partners. But what about the demand side? Like, you know, how did you get customers to download and apply for a credit limit?
So that turned out to be not that difficult a problem, because by the time, you know, people were already happy downloading apps, and, you know, thanks to Ola and Swiggy and everybody else had done the hard work of educating customers, right, to go online and download an app. So a lot of that happens digitally. We have partnerships as well. We tie up with some merchants now. So now we've expanded, right? We work with educational institutions, right? So we work with a number of players to now, but originally it was basically, people hearing about us through press, people hearing about us through, you know, digital advertising and so on and so forth, Google, so on.
Okay. And what is the onboarding process like? Like, how much time does it take to get an approved credit line and stuff like that?
So it's a two-step process. So the first step is pretty fast. It takes a couple of minutes. Essentially, we get a bunch of data and we quickly say yes or no. The second step, the customer cooperates, because we need to do the KYC, right? It's all regulated. So RBI regulations change from time to time, but fundamentally, there is some form of KYC that needs to be done.
Right.
And sometimes we have to, they want you to go in face to face and meet the customer and get a signature. Sometimes you can do it electronically. So it depends on the customer and depends on the banking institution.
Okay.
What they want. RBL, for example, will do a biometric KYC. They'll come to your house with a tablet and get your fingerprint.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Sometimes we can do OKYC on a thing. So, you know, this changes all the time. This KYC is like a, there used to be eKYC and then they stopped. This changes all the time, but whatever the regulation is, we comply with it, obviously. But once you get a credit line after the KYC, so you get pre-approved using your credit. So we evaluate you for credit, then there is compliance, right? But once that is done, then you get a limit. Then we pretty much never see you again, right? So it's all electronic.
Okay.
And at that time, whenever you want the money, you press a button, money comes to you. End of the month, you get a bill, you pay the bill.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Like auto debit or whatever, you know, ACS mandate, and, you know, there are a number of ways to repay.
Okay. And like, what about customers about whom you may not have data? Like, what happens there? Like, if a person has never taken credit before, then maybe the credit bureau won't have a, like, a score for that person.
Yeah. So our customer segment is people typically between 25 and 40. Our customer segment. Right. So for example, we don't lend to students.
Right.
And typically today we don't lend to, like, sort of complete blue collar, right?
Because there's no data about them.
Where there's no data. We do a small piece to them, just as an experimental. We are constantly trying stuff.
Okay.
But typically, you need some data, even if it's not credit bureau data. We can get bank statements, for example. Right? You need some digital footprint. Anything digital, we'll take it. Right? If you're completely off the grid, then we'll probably reject you.
Okay. Okay. So bank statement would then be like a manual upload process. Like
if no, it should be electronic. So you can either give a net banking or you can do a PDF upload or whatever.
Okay. And how has the growth been like from 2015? Like how many users signed up for it? And like, you know, how did that curve grow?
Yeah, it's been pretty pretty phenomenal. Forbes has written articles. I'll just forward you with a bunch of stats there. We've had basically a phenomenal growth. We're probably the number one in the country right now in terms of fintech in this category. So the growth has been, we've been lucky, of course. But, you know, we've disbursed about probably $500-600 million, as I said. We have over 5 million applicants. We've done about 150,000 credit cards, right? We've probably disbursed, you know, probably close to, you know, 10 lakh loans.
You have a credit card also now?
Also.
Okay.
Right? So the business is, you know, we are neutral whether you use a card or how you take the money out.
Okay.
Right? We just give you the flexibility.
Okay. And what is typically the interest rate that users pay?
It varies, except usually by the lender. It varies from 13% to 30%.
Okay. So, but much cheaper than a traditional credit card.
A credit card is 42%.
So right. Right.
Definitely cheaper.
What than next for you? Like, you know, are you looking at this for the next decade or so? Or do you think you will take on more of an advisory role and go back to being a VC? Or, you know, what's in your mind?
Good question. MoneyTap is sort of the end point at this point. I am on the boards of some companies, some of my investee companies and so on and so forth. MoneyTap is the end at this point.
So if you are as inspired by the MoneyTap story as we are, then download the MoneyTap app or just head to moneytap.com and maybe even apply for a loan while you're there.
If you like the Founder Thesis podcast, then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. Visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.